Okay, so today, as you can see, I'm on a Zoom call because my guest hardly ever stays still. Mike Parsay, known affectionately as the Phileas Fogg of horse racing. Mike, thanks very much for taking time out of your travels to speak to us.
Okay. I have to say, the first thing I had to do when you referred me to that is actually go and find out who on earth Phileas Fogg is, because I didn't have a clue.
Oh, surely
There we
not.
go. Never heard of him
Well,
before.
for anybody
Never
else
before
that
my time.
doesn't, for anybody else that doesn't know, he was the main character in Around the World in 80 Days.
All right.
And Mike does more race courses than Phileas Fogg visited country. So, Mike, how many days a week do you go racing?
At the moment I'm having a bit of a honeymoon, as it were, after a 2 or 3 challenging years in my personal life. So at the moment I've really gone to town this winter, and I'm going 5 days a week, and I've been going 5 days a week since the beginning of November, and really living this national hunt season the way I like it best. And traveling and going in and enjoying the racing. I would say once everything settled down a bit, it would probably end up being about 4 times a week. But it's a bit like it would be more in the winter and less in the summer.
Okay, so is national hunt racing your main passion?
Yes. I mean, I try from a flat perspective, I try to only go, apart from 1 or 2 occasions, only go to the race courses that don't stage national hunt racing, to make the sort of flat race going experience different to the jumps race going, as it were. Like Thurston, Ripon, and Redcar up here in Yorkshire would be, rather than Catterick and Doncaster, and for example, things like that.
Okay, have you done them all?
Yeah, done all the British courses, and I've done 8 out of 26 of the Irish courses, and my goal is to do the other 18 Irish courses this summer.
Okay, so we can probably safely say you're one of the most, especially as a recreational person, going racing on such a regular basis. Where did that love of horse racing stem from?
It's actually came to get just to move away from racing for a few seconds. It actually came from my childhood. I don't come from a racing background, but when I was a toddler, I can recall my earliest childhood memories, and never had an interest in anything that toddlers are supposed to be interested in. So my mother would buy me a copy of the Beano, and I'd be bored within 10 seconds of looking at it. And I'd look things like Disney cartoons and that sort of thing on telly. I think, this isn't funny, it's not entertaining, rabbits can't talk, so Bugs Bunny doesn't exist, and all that sort of thing. And I was very confused as a child. That all changed in 1974 when I watched ABBA win the Eurovision Song Contest. And that made me fall in love with music. And all I did as a child was focus 100% on the music scene of the mid-70s, which is why that's where my music grassroots remain. But as I got a little bit older, obviously, as I began to turn into a teenager as such, and your mind changes, listening to music wasn't enough. And one day I can remember vividly, I can even remember the date, it was the September the 13th of 1980, when I was not very well. I was basically confined to bed. I'll spare you the gory details, but the telly was on, and it was World of Sports with Dickie Davis. And it was just on because it was on, basically. There was nothing else to watch, because of course in those days, for younger watchers, we only had 3 channels. This was before Channel 4 even came along, so we only had the 3 channels, and 2 of them had sport on Saturday afternoon, so you more or less had to watch sport unless you wanted to watch a black and white film on BBC Two. And it was Sledger Day, which always remains and always will, always was and always remains my favorite flat race of the season. And it was the first race I watched with interest. And I remember Joe Mercer on light cavalry, Henry Cecil trained. And I remember seeing him in, I think it was Jim Joel, as I recall, the colours, or Charles St George, one or the other, I can't quite remember. And going in the colours, storming up the home straight on Tang Moor. And that was the sight that got me hooked. I just really enjoyed it. And then the following week, obviously, I was back to full health. And I watched again, and it was Sweet Monday, I think, winning the Millreath Stakes at Newbury, because I discovered it was on BBC as well. But it was the week after was the first race that I watched that I always remember. The real exciting first race I watched was Chris and Known Fact in the QE2, which was the following Saturday, the 2 top milers at the time. head to head right up the straight at Ascot. And it really went from there. Obviously, the jump season came along soon after that. Bright Highway winning the Mackeson and the Hennessy. Bresh Euro, Jenny Pittman's first big race winner in the Massey Ferguson. Narvik in the Welsh National. And I just watched it every week through the winter. And it was just, that was it. It was from there on. And then in the summer of 81, I started compiling a scrapbook and kept cuttings of every race meeting until I left school, basically. And then obviously the passion carried on as I turned into an adult and started doing the responsible stuff.
Were your parents sort of encouraging of this new love of horse racing?
They were tolerant. I think it's probably fair to say they let me do what I wanted. And my mum in particular did take a bit of an interest and watch it with me sometime on the TV, particularly in the latter years of her life. When within the last 10, 15 years, she used to watch it with me every Saturday when I was with her. And my dad was fractionally interested, but I mean, they didn't disapprove. They were quite happy for me to do so, you know, but it was, yeah, they were okay.
Okay, now you told me that racing became a hobby rather than a living for you when you became of working age.
Yes.
And you made your living talking. Can you tell, what were you doing?
Yeah, that's probably the only thing I'm any good at. I was an IT salesman. I still am. I mean, I've been an IT salesman for 37 years. I've worked for first jobbers in Swansea. Was obviously my parents, so I should explain, my parents were in West Wales. So my first city of work was where the first two places were Llanelli and Swansea. So Fos Las, in some ways, has been a bit of a local course to the family home in recent years. I worked in Swansea for 18 months for a trade union, showing training courses around on a database. And then I got a job in Birmingham, fell in love with Birmingham, came up on my 20th birthday. That was the 1988 Magnet Cup, which I seem to remember was a dead heat, but maybe I'm mistaken on that. I got offered the job, saw the job advertised in the Birmingham local paper. Accepted that, and I've been there ever since. And basically, I'm a salesman, IT equipment, which I sell into the NHS and local government. I'm not a technician. I don't recommend products, but if it doesn't turn up on time, it's my fault.
Okay. Now, you've told me that you've been diagnosed as autistic, which might come as a surprise to people listening to it. Wasn't until you were 44. I mean, how does it manifest right. itself?
I cannot deal with numbers and figures. I have anxiety attacks and a lot of things that people do very naturally, I have to work to do. And there were sort of things when I was younger, it was like, when I was sort of going out in youth hostels and that sort of thing, walking weekends and stuff, why does it take me twice as long to have a shave than most people and things like that? And I think in boxes, so that's why I can't drive. I can't focus on two things at once. Like, I'm talking to you right now, but if, for argument's sake, one of the cleaning ladies knocked on the door of this hotel room, I would completely have forgotten every word that we've just been talking about and things of that nature. Things that a lot of people find very easy, such as things like rewards websites, where you accrue points to get discounts and that sort of thing. I can't cope with those. There's too many numbers. There's too many things to actually think about, to know what's happening on there. It's just too much for me to handle. So anything that involves usually numbers or thinking or that sort of thing. And also I have severe anxiety from time to time, things of that nature. That's why I'm so grateful. Bobby Beavers has done an absolutely fantastic job to raise awareness of things. And it was at work when they saw I was struggling with basic tasks. They advised me to go and get checked by a psychologist. And I went through a load of tests, you know, shapes and all that sort of thing. Reproduction of data was the thing I failed most in. And that's where they made the diagnosis. Once they made the diagnosis, I went online, analysed the diagnosis, and all those pieces of the jigsaw puzzle fell into place as to why I failed to do certain things as a younger age. And ever since then, I've learned to live with the condition rather than fight it. And that's brought my self-confidence out. If when I was 34, you asked me to do this, I probably wouldn't have been able to do it because I would have been too scared to or too anxious to. Whereas since I learned I had it, it made me live with the condition rather than fight it.
Now, you mentioned Bobby Beag, this is this autism in racing.
Yeah.
There's been a much broader understanding of the condition in recent years. I mean, how has that positively affected you?
A lot of people who look at me and think weirdo when I explain why I'm behaving in a certain way in certain circumstances, there's a lot more acceptance. So they understand. If you tell somebody bear with me, I'm autistic, just bear with me whilst I finish this, they're very, very tolerant. Whereas before I knew it, they wouldn't be so tolerant. So I think people have understood. One of the things we'll be discussing later in this is cultural change. And one of the cultural changes is acceptance of so much more now that used to be considered almost frowned upon and ignored. And like my mother, for example, she refused to accept I was autistic, even until the day she died. She thought it was a load of nonsense. But she was born in 1938, a very, very different age than we live in now. But I think that acceptance and that sort of understanding of each other's how we are is probably one of the best things that's happening in the world, certainly in our country at the moment.
Okay, now I just want to finish. We've got some topics you want to talk about. We'll do in part two. But I was interested. You say you considered the years 1981 to 83 inclusive, the two greatest years in sporting history. Why is that?
Okay, let's just. I think probably what I should have said there was racing history. Okay, there were a few sporting events. I think when you look back on your life, everybody looks back on their life. Probably the most significant years and the best years is when you first discover life as a young teenager. You stop being a child and you become an adult and you become a lot more aware of what's going on in the world and you start to embrace the things that make you happy and you start living your life rather than being a child. And I think I would argue that most people probably think those are probably the most significant time of their life. For me, it was that racing era that kick-started when ITV started televising racing of the National Hunt season 81 to 82, on the day that Tua Gori Mu won the Queen Elizabeth II Stakes. It was that day and through to the day that Drumlagan won the Whitbread in 1983, on the same day that Cliff Thorburn did his 147 break in the snooker. And all the events that happened on TV as I was watching them unfold, but best of all was the racing, were probably the happiest memories of the sports or the sport I enjoy that I've ever had, because they were the great horses that became my equine heroes, my two-legged heroes, of course, the great man Michael Dickinson and his achievements. The best two-mile chaser I've ever seen, Badsworth Boy, my favourite horse of all time, Bregorn, and that fantastic flat season of 1982. Surely there's never been a better flat season before or since, with the superstars that dominated that summer. Sober, Ardross, Height of Fashion, Sandhurst Prince, Golden Fleece, etc., etc. All these great horses that have stuck in my mind forever, and they were the real linchpins of the sport for me as a fan. So that was, basically, it was that era that really cemented my love of racing and provided me with the happiest memories, certainly of my teenage life, and they were the ones that still stuck in the file of happy memories. I'm not saying there haven't been better horses since, but they were my favourite horses, and that was and your favourites are always the ones you remember the most.
Brilliant. Okay, Mike, we've talked about the what got you into the game and got your passion for it. You've got some strong opinions about horse racing in what is a challenging time for the sport. Should we start with the Flat Jockeys Championship?
Yes, I struggle with the Flat Jockeys Championship. I don't understand why it's created in the way that it is, because half the races in the flat season don't count towards the championship. And there's a lot of people who seem to perceive the all weather as the inferior. And it seems to me that all the jockeys who work hard through the winter to achieve their goals and successes, once we get to 2000 Guineas Day, their achievements count for nothing. And I think in a jockey's championship that's supposed to be rewarding the hardest working, the most successful rider through the year, I think it should be something that that encompasses all of the races throughout the year. If I were to wave my magic wand, I would still finish it as it does on Champions Day at Ascot. I would then have a week's gap with no flat racing, and I would restart it at Doncaster the following Saturday with the Group 1 Racing Post Trophy, and I'd bring the November handicap forward and call it the October handicap. And then the flat racing season would go in like a lion rather than like a whimper, with a Grade 1 race and a big handicap. I'd move the Pontefract Tankard from the previous Monday forward to the Sunday that week, because it's only entry in Wincanton on that day, so there's no flat racing anyway. You could market that as a Yorkshire racing weekend. And then from that, I would make every race throughout the entire winter count towards the championship. That means that every flat race run in this country would count towards the Flat Jockeys Championship, just the same as the National Hunt Jockeys Championship. Finishes at Sandown, you've got that week's gap, Hunter Chase Night at Cheltenham, you Toxeter gets things going again on the Saturday. And I can't understand why so many people, so many hard-working flat race jockeys have their efforts unrewarded in the Jockeys Championship by what they do in the winter. You shouldn't have, for me, one winter and one summer. It should, flat racing is for, and all racing is for everyone.
Absolutely. And right, a fairly recent phenomenon, student days.
Well, if you asked me this time last week, I would probably say, well, you know, they're all right. You know, I'm glad it's only six times a year, something like that. But last weekend were the 2 days, Saturday and Sunday at Doncaster. Now, I know this is something that started originally in Ireland. And one of the questions the BHA are asking, or a lot of people are asking, is we need to get more young people into racing. Well, I think what I saw last Saturday and Sunday left me astounded, frankly. And I took some time out to have some conversations with the students. And their perception of racing was eye-watering in my eyes. And it was very interesting because, unlike what certain people perceive, they were coming up to me as somebody they could see with the race card and notes and all that sort of thing. They could see that I was a fan, and they were asking me and other people there to tell them about what was going on, to tell them about how to look at horses and how to what to look for, what the processes are and all that sort of thing. But I asked them about racing in general and how they saw the sport and why they came. And they said, because the guy who runs Invades actually puts it out as a day out on their websites. And they saw it as a great way for to have a really good day out with all their mates and have a good time and get interested in something that they haven't seen before. Don't get me wrong. Of course, there were a few people who had a bit too much to drink, but nowhere near as many as you see after Cheltenham or somewhere like that. And how they saw racing, and it was very interesting when two students in their final year, I asked them, how do you see racing? And they said, well, apart from us here, all I can see is older men. So they actually said that they perceived racing as a sport that was only followed by older men, which is why they weren't, for the older generation, which is why they weren't encouraged to come until Invades came along and said, look at this, this is a great day out. Now, I also asked them, would you go again? And the two I spoke to in particular at length said they wouldn't go again if it wasn't an Invades day. And I said, why is that? And they said, because we don't know when the meetings are. We don't know when the other race days are. Because they're not racing fans originally, they're not looking around at websites. They're looking at their student social websites. So if I was Invades now, if I was the BHA, I'd be getting on the phone, because there were 6,000 students from one university there on Saturday. There were 5,000 students from one university on Sunday. So how to get young people into racing? Why not the guys at Invades put an entire fixture list at Doncaster or Uttoxeter or any of those places on their websites so that the students can see, we don't just have to come in a coach load. We can come, if we want to come racing, One was at Leeds, one was at Nottingham. So why not the fixture lists at Wetherby? Show that for Leeds. The fixtures at Nottingham and Southall for Nottingham. It's quite obvious that young people do want to come racing, and they do see it as a way out, as a day out, if it's projected in a way that's of appeal to them. I mean, don't get me wrong, the music room at Doncaster resembled sounds that I'd normally probably more likely to hear on a McAlpine construction site. So it's not the sort of thing that I would personally wish to go and listen to, but it's what they like and they enjoy it, and there's no problem with that. So we need to get more young people interested in racing. What I witnessed last weekend was an astounding success in achieving that, and the behaviour was nowhere near as bad as certain people would perceive it to be.
Okay, now we've changed the wording on this for diplomatic reasons. Racing appears to be run by people who can't face cultural change.
Correct. Yes. Yes. The problem is, I think racing's always been perceived for hundreds of years as the sport of kings. There's always an element of the old-fashioned, antiquated Victorian class society, which is gradually dying. The last bastion of which is, of course, Royal Ascot, that I just simply refuse to go to. I think that a lot of people within racing do not see, they're looking at it from the inside of the bubble out rather than the outside in. And there are so many things, such as the continuation in some places of enclosures, of segregation. And please don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking about the safety, integrity segregations, such as the inside of paddocks and weighing rooms and sadly enclosures and all that sort of thing. That's absolutely right, and quite rightly so. But I'm talking about TATS members, Silver Ring, all the old traditional things that are gradually dying. But a lot of the major meetings, they remain. People don't like that kind of approach to things anymore. Young people don't like to be told, don't go here, don't go there. You've got to have a badge to go here and do this there. And I just think that the people running the sport need to understand, if they want to modernise racing and take racing forward, they've got to see what's going on out there and how people perceive racing from outside. And some of it doesn't make for very pleasant reading or listening. Like, for example, after the Grand National last year at our place of work in the office on the Monday morning, sadly, the horse they weren't talking about was Corrick Rambler. It was Hill 16. And that sort of thing, you know, bringing the race forward to 4 o'clock, I don't quite understand what that achieves, frankly, when the meeting used to build to the Grand National as a climax. They've now pushed a Grade One chase to 5 o'clock in the evening after the National, which would be totally ignored by everybody. And I don't quite understand. I don't think people have cottoned on to what should happen in things like that. Sometimes they just, I don't understand why they do things the way they do. Whereas it's very different out there than how the people running racing seem to perceive from inside. There are, of course, exceptions.
Premierisation runs the risk of killing the grassroots of racing. And I won't say what you said when you'd do if it happened, but, you know, you're taking it very seriously.
Yeah, I do, because I think racing is every bit as much about the superb events going on at Catterick this afternoon as the mecca of racing, i.e. Cheltenham, next week. There's no harm in saying every sport has to have its championship events. Every sport has to have its big events, like Cheltenham and Aintree, like, you know, Goodwood, Ascot, etc. Because that's all, everything has to have a pinnacle. But without the roots, you can't just run a sport on its fluffy branches. And to give you a classic example, which for me was the stab that premierisation just openly showed. The first Saturday of the year, this year, first premierisation goes off. Unfortunately, Sandown is abandoned. The prize money at Newcastle was lower this year than on that day last year, but the prize money was higher at Sandown than it was last year. Sandown was abandoned. The meeting was not rescheduled. Refer to my previous point about people not getting used to cultural shame. Why on earth couldn't Sandown have been rescheduled to the following Sunday If it's a premierisation fixture, you don't abandon Premier League football fixtures. If Arsenal versus Man United is abandoned because of a waterlogged pitch, it's not forgotten about, it's not ignored, it's rescheduled for another day. So if you've got a premiership, you mustn't abandon any Premier meetings in the same way you wouldn't abandon any Premiership football meetings. But where's that money gone? So there's less prize money at Newcastle, more at Sandown. Newcastle went ahead. Sandown was abandoned. What's happened to Sandown? And that sort of question. So it's almost as though they're just interested in putting more money to try and keep more horses in this country at the top level, but they're taking more money away from the bottom level to do so. I hope somebody's watching this and says, he's talking utter rubbish. Let me explain why. That's what I'd like to hear from somebody. But, you know, it's as much about Catterick today. It's as much about the all-weather meetings on the flat as it is about Ascot and Goodwood. And everybody has their part to play in the sport. There's no such thing as a rubbish race, in my opinion.
Okay, does it matter to you if you're at a Premier meeting or Wolverhampton?
No, not at all. Each meeting is special. Each meeting is special. It doesn't matter. Yesterday night, there was a lovely grey ridden by Joe Mason, won the penultimate race. An absolute joy to watch. I think his name was the Tarn. I just can't quite recall. The something. He won at Wolverhampton about four races ago. Went slightly off the boil for his last two runs. He's come back to his favourite course. It was a joy to watch. Lovely grey and storming home. And yeah, that was great. It was as big an event to me as the racing at Cheltenham.
Okay, now we'll talk about your betting or lack of it later, but you describe horse racing as another addictive chapter, like a Netflix series or a book that you can't put down.
Absolutely. Every race is another chapter in the soap opera, because each and every horse is a character. We're not talking like Formula One machines here. We're talking living creatures. We're talking beautiful animals. And each of them has their own character, has their own quirks, has their own ways. And as they intertwine with each other, each race is another chapter in that story. So you can see horses who've just performed their best ever performance. Sometimes they have off days, things of that nature. And that's what it's a page turner to me. I just can't stop reading the book. And every race has something. There'll be six more stories in that chapter will be unfolding at Catterick this afternoon.
Okay, and just finally, to put things in perspective, you're at Catterick today. I met you last week at Taunton. You go all around the country. I mean, how do you get about?
Public transport is the key. Sadly, within the last two or three years, the reliability of public transport isn't quite as good as it used to be, which increases the expenditure slightly, because it would make sense to do a lot of these on day returns, but I just can't trust the trains as they used to do. But really, if you do your homework, and if you plan in advance and you know where you're going to be going on what days, it's not too bad. And if you actually plan ahead and know when the trains are going to be and know when you need to stay in hotels or when you just want to stay in a hotel for pleasure or whatever, I just think it's a case of planning in advance. You've just got to plan two or three. I mean, it's more difficult in this country than it is in Ireland. Ireland have got a far better public transport network than we have. There's quite a lot of things Ireland do better than we do, but that's another story. They have the public transport network is so good over there. It's easy to get about from Dublin Airport to different places. Over here, you need to do a little bit of strategic planning. But it's not too difficult. Not too difficult.
Okay, Mike. Right. So we've already ascertained that you're probably one of the most prolific race goers in the UK at the moment. How do you find your experience generally?
Not as good as I did for the first 15, 20 years, 25 years of my race going life. There are things now that mean it's not as enjoyable as I did, as it used to be. I know that we have a security issue now in this country. We have certain things going on out there that perhaps weren't happening 20, 30 years ago. But I think I just wish that there was another way of dealing with racecourse security than ransacking people's rucksacks when they enter the front door, particularly as somebody with high anxiety. Sometimes I wonder how called for it really is. but I'm not one to, I don't know what the relationship is with the police and people of that nature, whether it's considered essential. So I think front of house is always special, and I find most race courses, because of this security business, extremely unwelcoming at the front door, which is a shame. So the race going experience usually is preceded by anxiety. I mean, today, for example, Catterick, they have a policy of their bags, you have to empty the bags out at the front entrance. They don't actually search it themselves. You have to take everything out. So I've obviously got three changes of clothes, all that sort of thing in there. So if I had my rucksack with me at the front entrance today, I would have to empty it before I go through the door. And that sort of thing. Thankfully, there's somebody looking after my rucksack for me today, so I don't have to worry about that. But, you know, things of that nature. So the actual race-going experience isn't as good as it used to be. But once you're in, the racing, albeit at various different levels, is superb at the smaller tracks. At the bigger tracks, yeah, it's all right. But sometimes it doesn't quite flow the way I'd like it to do with you know, dress codes and things of that nature. Everybody who follows me on Twitter knows my views on dress codes. I'm not going to spend 20 minutes warbling on about that right now. But on a very, very hot summer's day, at certain race courses, if you're forced to wear a jacket, well, almost for OAPs, that almost poses a health risk. And things of that nature. So I think we really should take a leaf out of Ireland's book, because the race going experience in Ireland, it remains an absolute joy from start to finish. And the proof of the pudding in that is that the nice challenge Leopardstown now faces, when they had a crowd on the first day of the Dublin Racing Festival, approximately 2,500 larger than they could cope with, which caused a certain amount of unpleasant experience, but no disorderly behaviour or anything like that, because they become a victim of their own success simply because they welcome people through the door, and a third of the crowd were British people who've had enough of the Cheltenham experience, etc., and went to Leopardstown. Now they've got that sad situation that they haven't got enough room for everybody.
Your best and worst experience on a race course.
My best experience on a race course was without doubt the first day I ever went national hunt racing. It was the first day I ever did anything without being under the guidance of mum and dad. So if you like, it was the first day out that I paid for out of my earned money, if you like. And it was Monday, January the 6th, 1986 at Chepstow, the day that Last Suspect made his reappearance after winning the Grand National the previous year. I just was in seventh heaven from start to finish. I wasn't in the real world. I was up in the fluffy clouds somewhere. It was just a day I'll never forget all my life. And I walked the course after racing as well. I'm sure the clerk of the course wouldn't be very pleased with me if he knew that. But I walked the course after racing and actually looked at the fences in close up and all that sort of thing. And of course, one of the very, very rare occasions that a Grand National winner has won his next race after the Grand National. Which is, I think, very, very, Many Clouds is the only one, I think, who's done it since, if I'm not mistaken. I'll be wrong on that. But it was a wonderful day, and it was just a wonderful experience to be free and independent for the first time in my life. And it didn't really matter who the horses were, although Last Suspect, obviously, it was great to see Last Suspect in the flesh. That was the best. The worst experience ever was undoubtedly Royal Ascot Ladies' Day 1988. An experience I never want to go through again. It was horrendous. We were like cattle because we're not allowed in the main enclosure because we haven't got the city clothes. So we were shoved down the course. Nobody was interested in the racing. It was just full of drunken people getting more drunk. Royal Gate was disqualified, which I was screaming the place down when he won the champion hurdle 4 years later. The most biggest injustice I've ever seen on a British flat race course. Because some pen pusher had to tick a box, was the only reason why he was disqualified. And I went home saying, never again. And I've never been back to Royal Ascot since.
Okay, now, you don't bet. Tell me you don't bet. Many people watching will wonder how you can be so passionate about a sport that is so intertwined with betting and you don't bet.
Well, that's an interesting point. Why is it intertwined with betting? You know, the only people, gamblers probably think racing is intertwined with betting, But maybe some of the people, for example, and I didn't ask those students last weekend whether they considered whether, in fact, I should have asked them that. Was it essential that they had a bet on their day out? I don't know. But the fact is, there's two things. One is I got dyscalculia as part of my autism, which means anything to do with figures and numbers is a complete mosh in my head. So, and I believe to be a successful gambler, you have to be a good mathematician. You don't have to, if you're a racing fan, I put a star against a horse in every race. And frankly, I haven't got time to study the form to the extent that professional gamblers do and that sort of thing. So, but also I believe in return on investment. Every penny I spend, I like to get a return on investment. If I spend a foolishly large amount of money on a nice London hotel stopover, I get a return on investment of the luxury of staying in that room and having the luxury breakfast and being in those surroundings. If I have a fiver on a horse and the horse loses, I get no return on investment. I've lost a fiver and I'd be cursing all day because I've lost a fiver. I hate it. I hate losing.
Could you not quantify that with that part of that fiver goes towards funding racing?
Well, no, I'd rather give it to the Injured Jockeys Fund if that's the case.
Okay, so have you ever had a bet?
Yes, I've had a few. I had three bets on December the 30th, 2006, when I was after the Christmas meeting at Leopard's Clan. I didn't fly back until the Saturday night of the 30th instead of the 29th. Those days, we didn't have smartphones, so we couldn't monitor racing. So I wanted to go and watch the racing at Ascot and Haydock. So I went into a Boyle Sports in Ireland, and I felt it was right to, because I was in the room, it was right to spend some money with them. So I had three or four bets. One won, Amaretto Rose. The others lost, but I broke even. So I got away with that. And since then, I had one fun bet in 2018 with a friend of mine on a horse called Kylie Rules. It was just a fun fiver. Kylie Rules lost and went on to win his next three races when I hadn't put any money on him. So, and a little story from my childhood, which was a lesson learner. On the first day of Royal Ascot 1982, I was only 13. I selected all six winners on the cards. So it would have been a jackpot if I'd bet on them. Mr. Fluorocarbon, Kind of Hush, Dara Monarch, Horage, Dish Dash, The Popsiest Jury. And because I was a 13-year-old idiot, I was bragging about it to the teachers at school the next day. So they said, fine, we'll have a horse in each of the races on the Wednesday. I gave them six horses, oozing with confidence, couldn't get a horse in the first four all afternoon. And the biggest humiliation of all was a horse called Circus Ring, was 7-2 on favourite for the Coronation Stakes. I told them it was absolutely unbeatable. It was 5th of 6. And that was a lesson learned.
Those names are obviously indelibly etched in your brain. Do you think subconsciously maybe that trauma of what the fortune that could have been has put you off betting?
No, it was the trauma of the grief I had from the staff after the six losers I had on Wednesday that put me off betting.
Now, you say you put a star next to each horse, you know, and so you do, it is of interest to you to try and work out who's going to win the race. I mean, how often are you right? How good a punter do you think you'd be?
Well, I'd say on a six race card, I might get one.
Right. Okay. So probably punting isn't the... might put you off totally then if you decided to do it full time.
No interest.
Okay, Mike, part four. So you go racing 5 days a week. You love it in Ireland. You don't really, you're not really a fan of betting. But have you ever considered becoming an owner, be it a horse outright or a member of an owner's club or something like that? Do you want to get more involved?
No, not at all. And the reason for that is quite simply financial. There is a limit to the leisure pound. Everybody has a different leisure pound size, and there are limits. And the fact is that hotel accommodation, train fares, annual memberships at racecourses, which I've got seven annual memberships, and all the accommodation and going racing that is the limit to my leisure pound. So there's no room for anything else. And also, if I was a part share in a horse and that horse was running at a meeting and I wanted to go to another meeting, it's a tie down in many ways as well. Whereas I just love the sport in general. But the biggest reason is financial. There is a limit to the pocket.
Are you the sort of person that would enjoy going to a stable and getting up close and personal with a horse? Seeing that side of it?
It's something I wouldn't mind. Ben Haslam very kindly invited me two or three years ago to have a look around the yard, and it was an interesting experience just to have a look at the horses in close-up and everything. But I think it's important to stress that I'm a horse racing fan rather than a horseman. And I admire horsemen and horsewomen because they can talk to the horses. You have to have this. I think it's a natural instinct to be able to communicate up close and personal with horses. I would like to understand more about judging horse flesh. Anthony Bromley wrote a very, very good article in the Racing Post a few years ago where I picked a few pointers up from that. But I suppose I'd like the opportunity to learn to communicate with horses a little bit better, because there was a Meet the Grand National winners at Aintree a few years ago, and I was introduced to Pinot de Ray. And I could see by the horse's eyes, it was like, who's this coming up anywhere near me? Go away. You know, there was no communication there, and the horse saw me as a threat, and I was a bit scared. And so, yes, I'd like to learn to understand horses more. But stable visits, yes, if the opportunity presented itself, it would be lovely to do so. And I have been to a couple. But, I mean, for example, Lambourne Open Day, I'd rather be at Newcastle.
Okay, you say you've got seven memberships. What just out of interest, what courses are there you've membered?
Jumps Only, Sandown and Newbury, otherwise in full Cheltenham, Hexham, Cartmel, Stratford. I've just joined the Chester and Bangor combined, Punchestown, and did I say Hexham? I think that is it. Yeah. Perth I've got as well for the summer.
Okay, now you told me that racing has greatly helped you through tough times. So how would that be?
Escapism. I think the way I would describe escape racing is escapism remaining real. If you go through my book collection, you won't find any novels, but it's littered with autobiographies. I don't like fiction. So my escapism has to be fact. My other great escapism is music. But I've fought loneliness during the 90s, bitter loneliness through 5 or 6 years. And racing was always the thing that got me out of that feeling. During the death of my parents, when I had to deal with my mother's estate single-handedly, racing got me through. She died on the 19th of December, 2022. I spent the whole of the Christmas holiday watching all the racing on TV. So I watched every race from Boxing Day to New Year's Day. That diluted the other things that were going on within a week of her death. And that sort of thing, you know, it's my go-to place when I need cheering up.
Okay, so what is it about?
Thankfully these days I don't need cheering up quite as much as I did on occasions in the past in my life, but I still go racing anyway, so I don't just go racing to cheer me up.
Okay, what is it? Can you tell us exactly what it is about going racing that does it for you? What you've got a passion for it. What is it?
Jim McGrath once owned a horse called Fresh Air and Fun, and that's a good starting point. I'm very much an outdoor person. My favourite ceiling is the sky, and I like to be out in the fresh air. I'm a keen walker anyway. I do a lot of walking. I walk at least 10,000 steps a day. Maybe sometimes 15,000 to 20,000 steps if there's a lot of walking involved, you're out with the horses. I love to be out with the horses all the time to see them in it going round and everything. To actually come in on the track, you've got the anticipation of the day ahead. You're settling down to watch what you enjoy, and you're having a look through the card and all the rest of it. It's just the absolute perfect day in every way outside with the horses.
Can you not get that same buzz watching it on the telly?
No. The only advantage of watching on TV I mean, I don't watch live racing on TV, but I've got the racing TV and at the races, and I watch all the replays when time allows. The only advantage of that is that you're able to watch the time allows to watch racing from all the fixtures. Whereas if you're going racing, the clock just doesn't allow to watch some of the away meetings and things. So that's the only advantage. But no, I'm not really a TV person.
So
I'm
you
an
don't,
SMA.
so you wouldn't sit at home watching the racing on the telly if you couldn't make it for a day.
Well, if I couldn't make it for a day, I'd watch for a while, but I'd probably be crawling up the walls after about 2 hours. So I'd probably have to go out for a walk or go and do some shopping or something like that.
You mentioned your walking to a passion of yours as well. Do you manage to combine the two hobbies?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, it's 12 miles walk every time I want to go to Bangor from Rhiwabon Station, and there's a very nice pub on the way past back called the Cross Foxes, which I usually
How
call
far is
into.
it?
But 6 miles each way from Rhiwabon Station to Bangor.
Well, you walk it.
Yeah, both ways. Yeah,
Now that.
and thankfully Bangor is a spring and autumn course more than a midwinter course. And the days when Bangor race in midwinter, there's other meetings I normally want to go to. So normally when I go racing at Bangor, you've usually got 2 hours of daylight after the last to get back. But no, I'm not bothered about the weather. There's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing for the weather. That's simple as that. There's no problem there. But the only exception I would say to that, the only weather that I would run inside and wouldn't go anywhere near outside is thunder and lightning. I will not be seen outside during thunder and lightning. That's it, petrified and stuff. So, but aside of that, heavy rain and strong winds, I'm not bothered about at all.
So when do you start planning your year? Do you plan it that far in advance, or do you do it weekly? Do you do it monthly?
Usually, when the fixture list comes out in September for the following year, I'm usually planning for up to a year ahead. Like the other day, I was up till the early hours sorting out my Irish visits, because this year I've got one ambition this year now. There's 18 Irish race courses I've yet to go to, and I've planned them all out to visit this year, because now I've taken semi-retirement, I can do a lot of the things I couldn't do before when I was in full-time employment. And the big goal this summer is the 18 Irish race courses I haven't been to.
Awesome.
And that's, sorry.
No, you carry on.
So that's obviously taken a lot of planning to know where I'm going to stay. And the final piece of the jigsaw puzzle fell into place with Listowel a couple of days ago.
So you're going to do it in one hit. You're going to go over there and then work out a route to do them all in one
Yeah,
trip.
but no, it'll be over about 10 trips, over about 10, 11 trips, backwards and forwards. But it's easier to get to Ireland. It's easier to get to Ireland from Birmingham than it is to get to Scotland on the train from Birmingham. It's 40 minutes on the flight. It's the double, absolute double. I've been to Naas and Navan on a day return this year, and I was less tired when I came back than I went to Kelso on a day return. You know, Ireland is because of the planes, it's dead easy. And I'm really looking forward to it. And also next year, as one-offs, I hope to go to Dubai and the USA, but they're not at the top of my list of priorities. I am looking forward to going to Cannes Sumer at Christmas this year. That is something else I've got on the list for this year.
Are these race meetings further afield something new, or have you been further afield already racing other than Ireland and Great Britain?
I went to Paris six times between 1996 and 1998 to do the French tracks. I haven't been since. I hope to go back this year to visit the new Longchamp, but I don't know why, but the French racing didn't really light my fire like it does in Ireland and Britain. But I wouldn't mind going to see the new Longchamp, perhaps on Prix de Moulin Day or something like that, and perhaps do a revisit to a couple of them. But I think it disappoints me. The negativity I read on social media disappoints me, because it's the old thing: how many National Hunt fans does it take to change a light bulb? 50, one to change it, and 49 to tell you how much better the light bulbs were 40 years ago. And things of that nature. You can't. Racing evolves like everything, and at the moment, the best horses are in Ireland. Now, the reasoning for that is another topic of discussion. We take another hour just talking about that by itself. But for the moment, the best horses are in Ireland. So we have to encompass what we've got. And even though we probably haven't got the greatest steeplechasers of all time at the moment, we've still got the steeplechasers, and we've still got racing. And like things like last week, for example, Susan Corbett had a double, super trainer up on up in the Kiel de Forest. Small trainer, she had a double. One on Saturday, one on Sunday. That's to Susan, that's a Cheltenham double. You know, a small trainer with two big winners at a Grade One track, which incidentally is my favourite Grade One dual purpose course in the country, Doncaster. So that's a big event to Susan and her team of owners, and we should embrace that as fans as well as a big event rather than just the Cheltenham events.
Okay, finally then, Mike, as a fan, and you know, you've certainly got a right to your opinion, the amount of support you give to racing, what would you change?
Me? I would, all the big races, I would hold outside the Monday to Friday 9 to 5:30 working week. So in other words, I would make Cheltenham Festival Thursday to Sunday with all the handicaps on Thursday and Friday and all the Grade Ones and Grade Twos on Saturday and Sunday. People will be screaming at the screen this very second that I say that, but you ask my view. Basically, I would mirror our calendar more or less the same way they do it in Ireland and France, because in Ireland and France, all the big races, apart from the festivals, do take place on Saturdays and Sundays. So, and I just think we've got to project our sport. We've got to tell everybody that we've got this greater sport. Martin Crothers said one thing in his interview when he said that it's difficult to sell national hunt racing abroad. That's correct. That's the same way as the USA trying to sell baseball abroad or the Irish trying to sell hurling and camogie abroad. It's their number one sports, but it's very difficult to sell it abroad. So that's fair enough from an overseas betting perspective and all that. So that's fair enough. But we've got the best national hunt racing in the world. Us and Ireland, we can stand proud that we've got the best national hunt racing in the world. And we should be singing that from the rooftops rather than moaning about it, because it's not quite as good as it was a few years ago.
Excellent. Okay, well, Mike Percy, really appreciate your time. Happy travels on the turf. Thanks, Mike.